From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Turkey's decision last week to send 10,000 troops to Iraq was answered by a suicide bombing outside the Turkish embassy in Baghdad yesterday. The Kurds don't want the Turkish troops in Iraq, neither does the Iraqi General Council. But Washington is looking past 400 years of history to what U.S. troops need right now, a breather and Ankara's assistance. Muslim troops dispatched to the Sunni Triangle tonight on Point, hope and fear as Turkey prepares to put boots on the ground in Iraq. But first we go to Jerusalem. Three Americans were killed in the Gaza Strip this morning when their vehicle was blown apart by a roadside bomb. The dead contract security workers hired by the American Embassy in Tel Aviv were traveling in a convoy of U.S. diplomatic staff. Earlier I spoke with Cameron Barr, staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor in Jerusalem. I asked him to reach for the message in today's bombing of Americans.
We have to enter the realm of speculation because we don't know at this point exactly who was responsible. This attack walks and talks a bit like what's known here as a roadside bombing, which is an explosive charge set by the side of the road. It normally targets Israeli settlers or soldiers. And Hamas, for instance, has had great success, to use its own terms, attacking Israeli tanks and destroying them with the same sort of strategy that was used this morning against an American diplomatic convoy.
But this seemed to be a deliberate strike on the American diplomatic convoy. They were, what, headed into the Gaza Strip to interview Palestinian candidates applying for Fulbright scholarships. Why Americans?
Certainly there's no shortage of antipathy for the United States among Palestinians. You only have to look at the aftermath of the blast, where Palestinian youths from the nearby Jabalia refugee camp, which is certainly one of the most crowded places on the planet, came out to throw stones at American vehicles carrying investigators who were coming to the blast site to investigate what happened. And those officials had to flee the scene under perilous conditions to get away from this mob of people throwing stones. The source of that antipathy is basically a perception that the Americans are not even-handed in dealing with this conflict, and the Americans are also the only recourse that the Palestinians have to try to find a party that can broker a settlement with the Israelis. The Americans are seen as the only party that can apply leverage on Israel to force Israel to comply with peace treaties. And what they have seen from the Bush administration is a very on-again, off-again approach to Middle East peacemaking. And right now we're in an off-again phase.
Americans have been involved in this whole scene for a long time, though. Is there a new level of anger? There's not much of a history of attacking Americans.
To be fair, the militant groups are very clear that their target is Israel, and what they oppose is the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands, and that they have no interest in broadening the conflict beyond that. It will be interesting to see if it can be determined who was responsible and what their agenda is. But for the time being, we can talk about the frustration that Palestinians feel against the United States. Partly it's coming after the Clinton second term, which featured an American president who was intensively engaged in trying to broker peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And the current president has not been anywhere near as engaged as the previous one.
The dead today were all hired security staff, contract employees of the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv, three of them. How many were in the party altogether that was traveling?
Typically, these vehicles carry 4 to 6 people. They're usually GMCs of one kind or another, sometimes vans. They're armored. Of course, the armor works better against attacks from the sides or the front or the back than from underneath or from the top. The Americans usually travel in convoys of 2 to 3 vehicles, so that the maximum you're going to get in any situation is the order of 12 people, maybe 15.
And how much traffic is there in American officials, in Americans in general, in and out of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank?
Well, this is a fairly routine occurrence. It sort of depends on the state of play in the peace process. If the Americans have a lot to do, if they're visiting people, if they're talking to officials, then it can be at least a daily occurrence to see a convoy of this nature enter the Gaza Strip at the Erez crossing, which is the main crossing point between Israel and the Gaza Strip. You occasionally see these convoys in the West Bank as well. They're very hard to miss, and they're very distinctive. And the presence here of the monitor, the special envoy, John Wolfe, who has been sent here to monitor the implementation of the so-called roadmap, as the current phase of the peace process is known, that has brought a new group of GMCs into town. We see quite a lot of them in Jerusalem here. So that's why I think it's hard to accept that this was a mistake or that the Americans were not intentionally targeted, because these vehicles are very distinctive. The vehicle today was carrying diplomatic plates that identified it as American. And when you see these vehicles, even from a distance, you know who is traveling.
The embassy today called for Americans to leave the Gaza Strip. How many Americans might that affect? And what about just the simple future physical interaction of Americans and American officials with Palestinians after an incident like this?
It affects on the order of several hundred people in Gaza. And these are mainly people who are working with aid organizations. A lot of them are Palestinians who carry American passports. It's going to inhibit American diplomatic engagement with the Palestinians. Already, it's fairly limited. The Americans have much less freedom of maneuver in going into the West Bank and Gaza than, say, European or UN diplomats have, because they feel much freer. They feel like they're less targeted. And unfortunately, the events of today vindicate the caution and the security consciousness that the Americans have had in recent weeks and months. But it's certainly going to slow things down, and frankly, things are pretty slow to begin with.
Cameron, a last question. The State Department spokesman in Washington said today the continuation of the violence is because of the failure of the Palestinian Authority to crack down on terrorist groups and to end their activities. Is that fair? Is the Palestinian Authority in position to crack down on the kind of terrorist activity that might have led to this attack?
I would broaden it a little bit, step back a bit. I mean, I think one reason why this violence continues is because there is simply a lack of hope on the Palestinian side, and even among some on the Israeli side, that there's anything constructive being done to ease this conflict. And when you're in a situation where people are as despairing as the Palestinians are today, then you'll find people doing heinous things. And today was just another in a long series of days with that level of despair.
Cameron, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Cameron Barr is staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with us from Jerusalem. It was a crucial victory for Washington when Turkey's parliament voted last week, giving a green light to dispatching thousands of Turkish troops to Iraq. Ankara's soldiers, for the first time, will give a Muslim face to the U.S.-led occupation, the first patch on a fractured U.S.-Turkey relationship. And it will give some U.S. troops, maybe at least, a rest from what's become a long, tough deployment. But Turkish involvement in Iraq comes at a price. There's money. Washington offered up $8.5 billion in loan guarantees to Ankara. And there's history. T.E. Lawrence led the World War I Arab revolt that rooted out the Ottoman Empire. But that was after 400 years of Turkish occupation. And the Turks are blood enemies of the Kurds, who anchored resistance to Saddam Hussein. Historians and analysts who know the region say that the long-term trouble Turkey's troops may bring to Iraq is not worth the short-term gain, even if Washington wants to internationalize the occupation, even if U.S. troops need a break, even if election 2004 looms. Tonight on Point, Turks in Iraq. Are U.S. troops so bone-tired that any assistance, especially Muslim assistance, should be welcomed? Or is Washington so desperate for help in Iraq and a political win that it's ushering in a disaster? Are Turkish troops a godsend or another terrible complication? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Ambassador Peter Galbraith, former U.S. Ambassador to Croatia. He's now at the National War College, where he specializes in Iraq, the Kurds, and South Asia security issues. Good evening and welcome, Ambassador Peter Galbraith.
Good evening. Good to be back with you.
It's good to have you back. And joining us tonight from New York is Asla Adintashbash, chief U.S. correspondent for Sabah, one of the largest daily newspapers in Turkey. She's also an adjunct fellow at the Western Policy Center in Washington, a think tank organized to promote U.S. strategic interests and Western values throughout southeastern Europe and Central Asia. Good evening and welcome, Asla Adintashbash.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Peter Galbraith, too, first. There's been a fair amount of crowing from Washington over their success in finally getting Turkey on board. Turkish parliament made the vote almost a week ago now. Turkish troops will come, something like 10,000, we're told. The commitment is for up to a year, which is not forever. Obviously, there was a lot of resistance to Turkey to being involved in the war, and they didn't let the U.S. Come in through Turkey. Now they're ready to send troops. What's your analysis of what it's going to mean for Iraq and for the U.S. job there?
Well, of course, the administration is very eager to get additional forces to share the burden, and there simply haven't been very many countries who have been willing to join in. The predominant attitude is you Americans decided to do this, and so you should bear the burden. And in that sense, getting Turkey or any other country to participate is a gain. But this basically ignores the specific history of Turkey in Iraq. Some of it is historical. Turkey ruled Iraq in the part of the Ottoman Empire for 400 years. Its departure was relatively recent, at the beginning of the last century. And, of course, this is a part of the world where people have long memories. But there's also a much more specific issue, which is the concern about the Iraqi Kurds, who were America's second most important ally, actually, in the war, and who stepped in where when Turkey refused to allow American troops to cross into northern Iraq. The Kurds stepped in, worked with the American special forces, and created the Northern Front. And the Kurds are vehemently opposed to having Turkish troops come to Iraq. They're even more opposed to having them cross Kurdish territory, as they must if they're going to get to central Iraq. And the Kurds got their allies in the governing council, Iraqi governing council, to oppose this.
Lay out for us why the Kurds are so opposed to Turkish troops coming in. And if they're deployed in central or western Iraq, not the north where the Kurds are, why is that such a big deal?
Well, it is because Turkey is very much opposed to the Iraqi Kurdish agenda, which is to have to retain the very high level of self-government they've enjoyed over the last 12 years. Turkey is afraid that a self-governing Kurdish province in northern Iraq might be the nucleus of a future Kurdish state, which could include a large part of Turkey.
Because Turkey has something like, 14 or 15 million ethnic Kurds within its borders and an active guerrilla campaign over many years, thereby Kurds for autonomy?
Well, that's right. There are about 4 to 5 million Kurds in Iraq, but 15 or more million in Turkey. And there was an insurgency in Turkey that lasted 15 years and cost some 30,000 lives. But the Kurds in Iraq actually cooperated with Turkey against the Turkish-Kurdish rebels, the PKK. So this is not a place, as things now stand, that is a real launching pad for attacks into Turkey. But it could be. If, in fact, Turkey and the Iraqi Kurds fall into conflict over what activities that Turkey might be undertaking.
We'll come back and look at the details, but bottom line, what's your concern, what's your fear of how this may unfold with 10,000 or who knows, maybe more later, Turkish troops in Iraq? How might this develop in a way that nobody wants to see?
Well, first, it's a real slap at the Iraqi Governing Council that has opposed this. And it suggests that the United States isn't really serious about letting the Iraqis have a say in their own affairs. And second, it gives Turkey an opportunity to make mischief, as it has been since March with a variety of incidents. And it raises all the old historical wounds. So I think that it is definitely not worth the price, and to some degree, the administration dodged a bullet when Turkey refused to allow troops to go in because it would have meant Turkish interference, and now gaining much less.
But now they're mixing it up. Asla Aydıntaşbaş, we've just got a minute before the break, but in short, you say, no, this is a good thing. This will help repair U.S. Ankara relations and maybe build a bridge between Iraq and Turkey.
I don't think there are historical wounds between Iraq and Turkey. Your opening statement, you referred to 400 years of occupation. That's sort of like saying Albanians are mad at the Roman Empire for occupation. I mean, this was before Iraq ever existed. We're talking about the Ottoman Empire here. And I really don't think there's a huge anti-Turkish attitude in Iraq. I mean, you're talking about T. Lawrence of Arabia. It was the Kurds of Iraq who fought T. Lawrence. It was Kurds fighting on the side of Ottoman Empire at the time, and many of the Sunni tribes fought the Brits against, on the same side as the Ottomans.
So you say, look, this can work. We'll come back and hear more. We're talking tonight about the Turkish solution to America's lonely deployment in Iraq and whether it will work. You can join the conversation. Are Turkish troops better than no troops? Dispel tired American forces in Iraq. We're at 1-800-423-8255. 8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Turkish solution to America's lonely deployment in Iraq and what its impact may be. You can join the conversation. Is an overeager White House buying long-term trouble with a short-term solution here? Or, even with its pitfalls, is some additional international assistance better than none? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, Ambassador Peter Galbraith, now at the National War College, specializes in Iraq, the Kurds, and South Asian security issues, joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. And with us from New York, Azle Aydintashbash, chief U.S. correspondent for Sabah, the major Turkish daily newspaper. And Azle Aydintashbash, you've laid out what you see as some of the advantages of having Turkish troops in Iraq. Can you share those with us?
Well, I think the problem we're seeing in Iraq is very localized. It's primarily in the Sunni triangle, you know, 5 to 7% of Iraq, perhaps. But the towns like Fallujah and Bakubat, Sunnis largely feel left out of the political process in Baghdad. They feel Shiites and the Kurds have sort of taken over things. Many of the tribes are not represented, and they're kind of associated with Saddam's rule, at least the Sunni rule, which the Ba'athist regime was perhaps seen as. And I think this is one of the problems we're seeing in terms of the political balances. Sunnis left out, angry. In addition to that,
so how can Turkish troops help that problem?
Well, in addition to that element, U.S. troops have had a bad record in some of the Sunni areas. There's simply bad blood in places like Fallujah. I was there in September. It's almost like a feud, you know, both sides hating one another. Turkish troops can help in a number of ways. We're talking about a very conservative area with even, you know, with some parts even you know, significant Wahhabi presence. It matters a lot to these people that, you know, the U.S. troops are Christian, infidels. And I'm not saying everybody, but to some. Secondly, I think that in some cases, U.S. forces have been a little bit reckless with the public. I mean, like, you know, you can't arrest a tribal leader and put a hood over his head in front of his whole family and village and whatnot, and then say sorry the next day. So
maybe Turkish troops coming in can ease a little bit of that friction. Peter Galbraith, how about it? First of all, Azle says, hey, what historical wounds? This was part and parcel of the Ottoman Empire. And in the most troubled area, the Sunni Triangle, these Turks will be fellow Sunnis. They won't be infidels. They can come in and smooth the waters here.
Well, the first point is that this is a part of the world that has a long history and a very long historical memory. We saw that in the Balkans in the 1990s, and certainly the issue of Turkey is very much alive there. We see it as between Israelis and Palestinians, and it's also true in Iraq. And the Turkish presence, the Ottoman presence, is not back at the time of the Roman Empire. It was 90 years ago that the Ottomans were defeated, essentially. So it's recent history.
Sunni Turks coming into the Sunni Triangle.
Well, the problem in Iraq is not religious; it is ethnic. It is a country that is fissured most prominently between Arabs and Kurds, and the Arabs who were oppressing the Kurds were the Sunni Arabs. The Kurds are also Sunni. And Turkey has been stirring up this ethnic pot by raising the Turkmen issue. The Turkmens were never even mentioned in Ankara until very recently.
The Turkmens, these are related ethnically to the Turks in northern Iraq, northwestern.
That's right. In northern Iraq, ethnic Turks essentially left behind when the Ottoman Empire collapsed. And many of the Turkmen parties have worked well with the main Kurdish parties, but Turkey has tried to stir this up as a tool to use against the two main Kurdish parties. And Turkey has sent in special forces and agents. The Americans arrested a few months ago a group of Turkish special forces, accused them of trying to assassinate the Kurdish mayor of Kirkuk.
And the Kurds have said if they come in across our territory, we will fight them. The Turks have said if we're fired on, we'll fight back against the Kurds. But with all of that, Peter Galbraith, what's the scenario that really has you bothered here? I mean, the Turks can be sent back home if it's a big problem, I suppose. How might this unfold in a way that keeps you up at night?
Well, the first point I would make is that there's very little gain here. We're talking about, 10,000 troops in the context of an occupation that's requiring close to 200,000? It isn't as if the Turks are going to lift in a significant way the burden on the Americans. But the other side of the coin is they have potential to cause lots of problems. The kind of scenario that you described of possibly clashes as they're crossing Kurdish territory, although I think that the Kurds may talk a tough line. I think, actually, they're quite responsible, and I don't think that that's going to happen.
Okay, so that's not so dangerous. So what's the problem?
The other problem is, Turkey will continue, I think, some of its games, particularly in the north, particularly with the Turkmens. But the larger problem with Turkey is that once it's there, it may not leave, and it may not leave if it sees Iraq evolving in a way that the Kurds want and that many Arabs want, which is a very decentralized state, somewhere between Canada and Bosnia, and not the kind of centralized state that Turkey is itself and believes Iraq should be.
They want power in Baghdad. The U.S. may want a federation. The Kurds certainly want a federation. You say the Turks will be dead set against
that. The entire Iraqi government, the governing council, the people who are in the opposition have endorsed federation. The Kurds are in the driver's seat. The federation will have only as much power at the center that the Kurds are prepared to give it, and that's going to be very little. I think it's the only way to hold Iraq together, because if you try to hold it together by force, it's going to inflame Kurdish separatism. But that's not how Turkey sees it. And getting Turkey in may put additional pressure, may try and reach some kind of temporary solution that would have more power at the center than there should be, and it could lead to the breakup of Iraq. That's the scenario I'm most concerned about.
That's a serious scenario. Peter Galbraith, Asla Adintashbash, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Stephen Walt. He joins me in the studio. He's professor of international affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. His recent publications include An Unnecessary War and Beyond Bin Laden, Reshaping U.S. Foreign Policy. And I should say An Unnecessary War has a question mark at the end of it. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Walt.
Nice to be here.
So you're listening to the conversation. What's your sense? Is 10,000 troops from Turkey a big deal at this point in material terms on the ground? And is it, or may it be, more trouble than it's worth?
Well, first of all, they're not going to have a significant military impact. As has already been stated, they're likely to be replacing American troops. So the overall number of troops in Iraq that are trying to provide security is not going to increase. Second, nobody thinks that our problems there have occurred because we were 10,000 troops short. If we only had 10,000 more, then we would have been able to pacify the place. In fact, we have far fewer troops than we would need to actually effectively pacify it. So 10,000 from Turkey, even if the U.S. force levels were going to remain there, wouldn't be enough. There's a recent RAND Corporation study that suggests you need about 20 troops for every 1,000 people in population to make a peacekeeping operation work. We had about that ratio in Bosnia and Kosovo. In Iraq right now, we have 6 rather than 20 for every 1,000 Iraqis. So we're well shy, and 10,000 Turks aren't going to do it. But finally, it's not clear how much impact they're going to have, given that it's going to be very difficult to bring them in there and keep them supplied and keep them from getting sort of ensnared in various problems. If we can't bring them in over land, if we can't bring
supplies. That is, if they can't come in through Kurdish territory.
Exactly. If they can't come in, fly them in
or take them around the Horn or whatever it might be.
And provide a lot of support for them while they're there. In fact, this may distract the American military that's still left in Iraq. So it may have some value for the administration in political or symbolic terms. You know, we've got another country in here helping us. But in terms of actual affecting the struggle for security on the ground, I think this will have at best no impact, and possibly a little bit negative.
Maybe not even get U.S. troops out of the Sunni Triangle, where a lot of the fatalities are coming. Could it cut down on the U.S. death toll? Will it be Turkish soldiers dying instead? And if it is that, might that create another political problem with Ankara?
I think that's hard to say. say, I mean, part of it is, you know, you don't have running battles happening every day. You have the opposition forces engaged in very sort of strategic strikes, very limited. If they want to continue.
Well, this described by Ricardo Sanchez there as 15 to 20 a day. That's no small number.
No, that's true. But we're not talking about
not
large infantry
battles
or large armored battles happening on a constant
basis. We know
the
scale of the deaths that are going on. There's still, it's far from nothing.
No, the United States is losing about one soldier every 2 days, mm-hmm. And has been since May 1st. But the point is that the opposition there can continue to focus its attacks on American forces if it wishes to. 10,000 Turks will not, in fact, change the fact that there will still be lots of Americans there and they will continue to be exposed. Moreover, if the opposition decides to target the Turks as well, then it creates, again, a further political problem for the Ankara government. Having taken this step, they have to then deal with the possible casualties. And if our goal is to try and bring more and more countries in here and there's no improvement in the military situation, it's not going to be an attractive venue to send additional troops from other countries.
So it sounds like you're saying it's all about politics. We'll come back and look at that, but I want to invite our callers in. We're talking about Turkish troops on the verge of being deployed in Iraq. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Is this a godsend or the path to a bigger problem? Regina's calling from Hull, Massachusetts. Hi, Regina. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The topic is really so important. I just can't believe the stupidity, from what I see on behalf of the administration, after bribing Turkey to bring them into Iraq. I really have some grave concerns about how those troops are going to arrive. Are they going to be going through the Kurdish territory? I mean, we're talking about civilizations that are so much older than ours. They haven't been distracted by Fox or Disney. They get the story from their ancestors.
But, Regina, why so stupid? If the administration wants to internationalize this conflict, they want to have Muslim soldiers there, so it doesn't look like all infidels, as Asla was saying earlier. 10,000, certainly it doesn't change the numbers that much, but, you know, U.S. troops are very strapped there, and a lot of them would like to have some time at home.
Oh, and that's the thing that's so sad about this whole case. And finally, Turkey has stepped up to the plate after they've been given a certain grant for their services rendered. But how are they coming into the country of Iraq? Are they going to be rolling along the highway, if there is one, you know, through the Kurdish territory? I'm talking about the civilizations and the total lack of consideration that the Bush administration has given to what these civilizations are all about.
Well, let's pick it up, Regina, and thank you for your call. Asla Adintashbash, let me put that to you. You were suggesting earlier that there's not, apart from the Turks and Kurds, that there's not a real clash of civilizations here, despite the colonial history. Peter Galbraith is not so sure that there aren't some wounds that remain from that. But how do you see it? Do you think Turkish troops will be welcomed with open arms? Does it really make them brothers under the skin with the Sunnis just because they're Sunni Muslim? I mean, they're Turks. That's a different tradition.
The governing council largely reflects the opposition in exile, predominantly, not solely, mm-hmm. but predominantly. Turks have been, what they've been doing in Ankara is for the whole summer, nearly, they've been having consultations and very intense talks with regional leaders from the Sunni triangle. They've invited about 25 people, tribal leaders, clerics, community leaders, and whatnot. And they have reached the overall conclusion that they will be somehow welcome or not opposed. People have said to them various things. There isn't one standard Sunni response. Some people have said, you're welcome, you know, you'll be our guest. Others have said, only come with a UN resolution. Some people have said, we don't want to be occupied, period, but if it's a choice between you and Americans, we'll take you.
But there's clearly organized opposition inside Iraq to occupation forces. What makes you think that won't extend to Turkish occupying forces?
Nothing. There will be an effort by Ba'athist elements and Saddamists to fight any force that comes there. There's an effort to destabilize Iraq, including Al-Qaeda element. There will be some relief in terms of the if they take the area that is adjacent to the Syrian border, which is one of the three areas that are currently...
Yes, the more western area. That's right, yeah.
There will be some, perhaps some relief in terms of cutting down on the number of infiltrations from the border.
But if Turks start coming back home in body bags, as American troops have, to a country that did not support participation in this war in the first place, and where it still seems rather unpopular to be involved, how do you expect, Asla Adintashbash, that the Turkish people will respond to that?
This is not to start with. I mean, Turks and the Turkish government are very reluctant to do this. This is why I disagreed with Ambassador Galbraith's characterization of this as a neo-imperial plan. They're very, particularly this government, is very reluctant to go, and they fought to limit the deployment period to a year. They have making sure that they had the chance to, and even now it's not certain that they will go back. A lot of wrinkles to be worked out, including the transfer and, you know, the corridor for forces protection and whatnot.
But you don't see them as chomping at the bit to get in. Peter Galbraith, how about that? If Iraq is so bent on playing a role, or Turkey is so bent on playing a role in Iraq on establishing some influence there, it sure has had a reluctant way of showing that.
But my argument is not that Turkey is eager to send troops. My concern is that Turkey is meddling in Iraqi affairs. It's very opposed to the political solution that I think most Iraqis want, and certainly that the Kurds want, and that its involvement will cause complications. But I don't think there's any neo-imperial plan on the part of Turkey. I think the government of Turkey essentially sees its role as defensive. But there is a lot of opposition to Turkey coming in, not just from the Kurds, but from the Iraqi Governing Council, the very institution that the United States set up as representative. There was politics in that governing council. The Kurds are an important component, so the others went along with them. And in essence, if Turkish troops come in over the objections of the governing council, because the Americans want it, it really does suggest that the administration is not prepared for Iraqi self-government, or for representative government, at least when it goes against what the United States wants to see happen. And I think that is also going to cause some real problems over the long term.
And Stephen Walt, if it's more about international political signaling then than effectiveness on the ground in Iraq, how effective do you think that has been, is being, will be? Is this buying the United States effort there a different face that's persuasive?
Well, we'll get some sign of this maybe in a week or two when they hold the donors conference. But I think it's unlikely that the Turkish move will suddenly bring a cascade of other countries to send similar forces. I don't think you'll see a wave of, you know, Egyptian and Pakistani and Indian and other troops.
So who's
there.
The audience then? Is it the American public?
I think part of it is. I mean, this is speculative, but the administration, I think, is now, in a sense, making it up as it goes along. They've got to show some signs of progress, and this is one thing that they can at least tout as a sign that they're actually accomplishing something.
We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the Turkish solution to America's lonely deployment in Iraq. You can join the conversation. Are Turkish troops better than no troops to spell tired American forces in Iraq? And can Turkey put troops in Iraq without acting on its long-term antagonism with the Kurds? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Turkey's decision to send troops to Iraq to help out with the American effort there, maybe 10,000 troops, maybe within the next few weeks, to stay up to a year. Interestingly, at this point, not longer than that. Looking at that decision, those troops coming into Iraq, and whether it will work, what its impact will be. My guests tonight are Ambassador Peter Galbraith, joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's at the National War College, a specialist on Iraq, the Kurds, and South Asian security issues. From New York, Asla Adintashbash, chief U.S. correspondent for Sabah, a major Turkish daily newspaper, and with me in the studio, Stephen Walt, professor of international affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. You can join the conversation as well. Is Washington buying a quick political and logistical fix that may come back to bite? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ali is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Ali. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I heard the conversation. I'm very interested that some all the experts, they're forgetting the really the foundation of this Turkish issue.
All right, take us there.
First of all, the Kurds today, they're really surviving and survived Saddam's catastrophe because of the Turkey. Turks, they're the one protecting them forever.
The okay? Turks are protecting the Kurds? I mean, you know that
the
there's been...
Turks, without Turkey, without Ankara, never Kurdistan would have been today. Never Talabani or Barzani would have ever survived. They were both rivals. In fact, Barzani himself invited Saddam to throw Halabja with chemical bombs. I never hear any expert will speak about the truth.
Well, hold it right there, Ali. Peter Galbraith, can you respond to that interpretation?
Well, there is a way in which Ali has a point, which is that President Özal in 1991 really led the international movement to intervene in northern Iraq to create the safe area that became the basis of this de facto independent Kurdish state in the north.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, the protection which was provided by the United States and Great Britain for 12 years, the Operation Northern Watch, operated out of an American base in Incirlik.
So why do you remain so suspicious of Turkey's motives if they've acted in a way in the past that, as Ali says, has given some comfort to the Kurds?
Well, part of the reason that it's been very pragmatic, they haven't wanted to have a million or more Kurdish refugees in Turkey, which was the situation they faced just after the Gulf War. And also there was a certain amount of pressure from the United States and Britain. And finally, actually, President Özal, who was partly of Kurdish heritage, had a rather different view than the Turkish general staff or some of the other political leaders. Although I have to say, I think the current government is also much less nationalist, much more open to the idea that Turkey itself is a diverse country and in some sense, therefore, more sympathetic to the larger Kurdish question. But there are elements in Turkey who see a huge threat in northern Iraq and who are, at this point, very much focused on opposing and stopping the political solution of federalism, which the Kurds want and which the Arabs have basically accepted. And that's the nub of the problem.
Ali, do you share that concern that if Turkey gets physically involved, it's going to try and influence Iraq's politics in a way that might not end up being good for Iraq or the U.S. effort to get out?
Well, I disagree because I have to say that the Arabs right now in the northern Iraq, they are absolutely looted. Their homes, their land, they're in much trouble than the Kurdish help. I think the Arabs now asking the Turks, and I know that very well because I have relatives there, they're asking Turks to help because the Kurds right now, they're asking for federalism. In fact, they're divided among themselves because everybody wants power. Number two, federalism for Iraq, that means Iraq divided to divisions, pieces and pieces.
Along ethnic lines, yeah.
That cannot be. Iraq used to be one Iraq, whether Turkmen's 5 million, whether Kurds, there's 6 million, 2.5 is gone, left country. Whether they're Arab, I don't know how many percent. Every one of them says they're Shiites now 60%, which is not true.
But it sounds like you're saying, like the Turks and maybe like Sunni Iraqis, that federalism won't work, that power needs to remain centered in Baghdad. But what if the Shia and the Kurds just aren't willing to accept that anymore? It didn't work out so well for them under Saddam.
To be honest with you, the Kurds, they have no other alternatives. They have lived for the last 10 years better than any Iraqis. They were protected. Even Özal was dead, other Turks protected. Other Turks allowed American and British protect them. But the rest of Iraq were practically destroyed completely.
Well, but that history has been turned over now. But we've got a picture from you, Ali, that opens our eyes a bit more. Thanks for calling. Özla Adintashbaş, what about it? Can you see Turkey accepting a federal system in Iraq if that's what's determined to be the only way to keep Iraq together? Or is that just anathema to Ankara?
Look, the future political structure of Iraq should be determined by Iraqis, not just by, the Kurdish leaders, Barzani and Talabani, and not just an unelected governing council at the moment. They don't represent They're what we have and the best that we have, but they don't represent all of Iraq. So at some point down the road, once there is a census and once there's election, once there's a constitutional process down the road, Iraqis will be able to determine their own future. As to how Ankara feels, I think many people are actually quite the opposite. I mean, many people are resigned to the fact that the future of Iraq will be a federation. The problem is not whether or not Iraq will be a federation. It looks like the future of Iraq will be a federation. One of the sticking points is that whether we're talking about an ethnic or a geographical federation, I think Turks would like to see a geographical federation. Many Arabs, Sunni or Shia Arabs, would like to see a geographical federation.
In other words, that doesn't emphasize the power of ethnicity, which the Kurds and Shia may not be so hot on, but we've got the point, yeah.
And as for the point Ali made, I want to also remind you that this whole Iraqi Kurdish versus Turkish hostility that we're talking about is really a recent phenomenon. I mean, Özal died in 1993, and over the last decade, more than a decade, Kurds have not only been protected, you know, with the safe havens provided from Turkey, but also all types of logistics, economical needs, infrastructure, everything has been coming from Turkey, and it's been a huge trade route, and not to mention the fact that Barzani and Talabani, the two Kurdish leaders in the area, go around the world with Turkish passports, I mean, with a red Turkish diplomatic passport provided by the Republic of Turkey. So it hasn't always been this hostile. I mean, they did side with Turkey in its struggle against the PKK, and they've just been, and not only that, received direct Turkish financial aid for a long time.
Of course, it's been part of a big international project up there as well, and all kinds of international pressure there. Stephen Walt, you've been paying some attention to Iraqi public opinion on this issue. Asla says, well, eventually Iraqis will decide all this for themselves. Iraqis already have opinions about the wisdom of bringing Turkish troops in. What do you know there?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, the past relationship between Turkey and the Kurds is sufficiently troubled that it's, the recent events don't overcome the fact that the Kurds do not want a large-scale Turkish role anywhere in Iraq. It's why they've said from the get-go they don't want Turkish troops coming through Kurdish territory in the north, and that's going to greatly complicate any effort to bring Turkish troops in. But more importantly, it's not just the Kurds. There was a public opinion poll conducted by an Iraqi research center, now able to operate independently, last weekend, which reported that about 90% of those they polled were opposed to the entry of Turkish troops. And this was a poll conducted on all the different ethnic groups there.
So this is sort of a national poll in Iraq.
Exactly. Now, one should take that with some grains of salt. I don't know how reliable it is, but that's a pretty stark result. Again, so you've got lots of different evidence here. The Kurds say no Turks through the north. The Iraqi Governing Council, which we handpicked, says we don't want the Turks coming in. And finally, there is some public opinion evidence to suggest that opposition to Turkish role is widespread throughout the different populations of Iraq. This really isn't all that surprising. No country likes being occupied, and no country in particular likes being occupied by troops from a neighboring country with whom they've had sort of delicate or troubled relations in the past. It's not all that surprising that the Iraqis are wary of this, and it's also not surprising that the challenge we're going to face is how to manage a Turkish presence there in a way that doesn't cause more problems than it solves.
Matthew's calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Matthew. You're on the air.
Hello.
Evening.
Hi. Thanks a lot. I just had two points, and I was wondering about addressing the idea that Turkey has a right to be invested in this situation, since they are a border country, and it's probably not enjoyable to have instability on your border.
You mean like Canada has a right to put troops in the U.S. or the U.S. in Mexico?
Well, if there was a threat or an instability here that would threaten Canada, you know, something like a lack of government or a lack of a federal centralization.
Yeah, well, I know the U.S. has asserted that right now, but a lot of other countries are pretty cautious about using that. But we take your point and your other angle.
The other angle is maybe not an important diplomatic move by the United States, but maybe an important strategic move, because they now have a border country that could be an ally or a long-term ally, that it is a national entity, where the northern Kurds are not a national entity in that sense, that they are a recognized country, you know.
You're saying Turkey as a sovereign ally of the U.S. in the region.
Right, yes, where we don't have too many allies.
We haven't had too many pitching in troops on this whole project. Matthew, thanks for your call. Peter Galbraith, how about the calculus of a neighboring country sending in troops? Is this natural and good because they have interest in how things turn out, or is this an invitation to intervention by other bordering nations of Iraq?
Well, that is precisely the dilemma. The first point is that there is no basis under international law for a neighboring state to determine how its neighbor should be organized. This is really up to the people of the country itself.
But now we're into this quasi-UN-sanctioned, U.S.-led coalition. I mean, it's not just a direct intervention by a neighbor.
But it also goes to the other problem, which is that if Turkey intervenes, the Iranians, who also have their ties with the Kurds and with the Shiites, and who are meddling as well, but certainly they're likely very much to increase their involvement, and perhaps other neighbors will as well. Just a word on the future of Iraq. The fundamental problem is that you cannot hold countries together where even some of the people, a significant population who are located in a geographically defined area, don't want to be part of the country. That's the problem with Iraq today. The Kurds, if you gave them a vote, at least in that part of Kurdistan that was free from Saddam for 12 years, do you want to be part of Iraq? Do you want to be independent? It would be 99% in favor of independence. The leaders are pragmatic enough not to pursue it. But that underlying fact remains. And the kind of heavy-handedness that comes from Turkey, and your previous caller, Ali, illustrated it when he's talking about Turkey perhaps intervening on the part of the Arabs, is exactly the kind of approach which, in my view, is likely to lead to the breakup of Iraq.
But you're saying the Kurds want it already. You're saying the Kurds, many of them already want that breakup. Are you supporting that idea?
Well, I don't think God created any country, and so if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But I think it would be better if Iraq held together, and I think the best way to do it is to satisfy those aspirations for self-government without actually going to the final step of having independence, and let the people of the country themselves, through a voluntary union, try to find the sufficient areas in common. And there are areas in common for Iraq, at least on a very pragmatic level, the benefits from the sale of petroleum that might actually hold the country together.
But
if you force them to do it, you're likely to fan separatism. And the administration, Professor Walt made a very good point, that is making it up as they're going along. That's really characterized the entire post-war period. They didn't have a plan when they came in. And from almost the beginning, when they allowed the systematic looting of Baghdad and didn't protect anything, up to the present, it has been very ad hoc. And I think this whole involvement of Turkey has simply not been thought through as to where it's going to lead.
But they've got to forge ahead. Part of what they need to do is have an international face on this, and they do need more troops, even if it's only 10,000. So it's easy to say bad idea, Stephen Walt, but there they are.
Well, there's two different ways to think about internationalization. One can imagine internationalization that's done in the context of a UN-organized, planned operation, but this is being done in a very ad hoc fashion and is unlikely to change the military situation, except it may make the political situation worse.
Well, too late to have everything planned in advance. Here's where we are, and the Turks are on the way. Thanks to all of you tonight. Asla Adintashbash in New York, thank you so much for being with us. And Stephen Walt here in the studio, thanks for joining. And Ambassador Peter Galbraith in Cambridge, thanks a lot for being with us tonight. Good to have you again. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.